than ever. And I think it's to that kind of a season that the writer says in verse 1, therefore we must pay much closer attention to what we have heard, lest we drift away from it. Or putting it another way, lest we lose the plot line. Because in disorienting seasons in our lives, it's really, really easy to drift away from what should be anchored in our lives. It's really easy to become disoriented where we wrestle with the uncertainties in a way that we have no idea which way to go. The writer of Hebrews is going to come back to three phrases, and we'll touch on these more deeply next week, Lord willing. But he talks about the dangers that you and I will confront, especially in a disorienting season. And the words he uses are drifting, dulling, and hardening. They're the three words you find over and over again throughout this letter, and they're the dominant dangers that you'll encounter in your story of walking with the Redeemer. Drifting, dulling, and hardening. And that drifting you find in the first word of chapter 2, which we've just read again. And so one of the ways that we get the plot line clearly in focus is by asking and answering four questions. And these four questions have a specific biblical answer. And they're not just about the Bible story, but these four questions have to be asked and answered of any story that you ever read or participate in. Number one, how did it start? Number two, what went wrong? Three, how does it get made right? And four, how does it end? Two of the kids that we're staying with right now went to see a movie with Dwayne Johnson in it. And I asked them, what was the movie like? And he said, oh, it's kind of a dumb story. But you know what? Those four questions were right there. How did it start? What went wrong? How does it get made right? And how does it end? Every story, including your story and mine. The biblical story has a plot line that answers those four questions. So, that's our outline for this morning. Starting with number one, how did this story begin? How did the plot line begin? Going all the way back to Genesis, you read in verse 2, the writer says, in these last days, He, God, has spoken to us by His Son, through whom He created the world. Verse 10, You, Lord, laid the foundation of the earth in the beginning, and the heavens are the work of Your hands. So very generally, he says, everything that exists started with You. You spoke it into being. That's how it begins. But going from general to specific, the author also quotes Psalm 8 and says, specifically, the story began with man being the pinnacle, the masterpiece of God's creation. And in verses 6 through 8, where he quotes Psalm 8, the author shows us that in creation, God gave to man special favor, special privilege, special dignity, and special dominion. All four are uniquely man's. The man whom God created in His own image. Special favor, verse 6. What is man that You are mindful of him, that You actively remember us? Out of all that You have made, You are actively engaged, mindful of, at work within man. Special privilege, verse 7, it says, only temporarily, You made Him for a little while lower than the angels, meaning at some point, even the angels will be beneath man whom God has created in His image. Special favor, special privilege, special dignity, verse 7, You crowned Him with glory and honor. It's a dignity that God treasures His creation, man. And a special dominion, verse 8, putting everything in subjection under His feet, meaning God has given complete authority and rule to man. So there's a uniqueness to how this story begins. God created it all. But to man, he's given special favor, privilege, dignity, and dominion, so much so that at the end of Genesis chapter 1, God looks and sees all that he has made, and he says, not it's good, but oh, it's very good, very good. And he says, be fruitful and multiply and subdue the earth. Now, we don't know how long it was. It might have been a couple of days. It might have been years. It might have been centuries. We don't know how long it was between Genesis 2, creation of everything that exists, culminating with man, Adam and Eve. But Genesis 3 comes, and something goes wrong, badly wrong. And verse 8 brings an ominous tone when it says, at present, we do not see everything in subjection to him. One commentator wrote it this way. He said, instead of following his intended design, we see man despising God's favor, abusing his privileges, squandering his dignity, and losing his dominion. And so Genesis 3 shows us that while it started beautifully and perfectly, it went badly wrong. Hebrews 2 introduces the idea of death, something that wasn't part of the created design. And that word death is repeated 5 times in Hebrews chapter 2. Verse 9 talks about the suffering of death. Verse 14, the power of death and the fear of death and the slavery, lifelong slavery, the shame that comes with death in verse 11. This is what Genesis chapter 3 brings. It not only went wrong, it went badly wrong. Years ago, I was invited to this exhibition where this world-renowned sculptor was doing a program. He's a Christian sculptor. And he brought a bucket, which he said he had scooped out of a clay bank in the Mississippi River, and he plopped it on a table, and there were less people than are in this room right now. And he began quoting Genesis chapters 1 and 2 from memory. And as he did, he squooshed his thumbs and fingers into this lump of clay that was about the size of a melon. And before my eyes, I still get goosebumps thinking about the wonder of watching this lump of gray clay become a man's head, ears, nose, and eyes emerging. And the man's gaze was upward, and he was a handsome man that the sculptor sculpted right before us, quoting Genesis 1 and 2. And the man had a look of wonder and discovery and childlike curiosity and brilliance and unflawed beauty. And he finished it and folded his arms and he said, and it was very good. And then he paused about that long, stepped forward, and he took his hand and went and crushed it. Pulled it apart piece by piece and threw it back in the bucket. And I was horrified. I said, man, I would have given anything to take that home with me. Why would you do that? You ruined it. I didn't say that out loud. I felt that on the inside. And when he was done pulling that sculpture apart, he held the bucket. It was almost like he was fighting back tears because he realized he had ruined something beautiful. And he tilted the bucket toward us and he said, this is your life now. A masterpiece. But because of the fall, it's ruined. It's cursed. There are still images of the created beauty that you can tell what was once there. But it's ruined. That's your life. That's my life. Where did it begin? The story began with a perfect creation. What went wrong? Well, sin came in and destroyed it all. And it leads us to the place where we are now, where it's so easy to lose the plot line. Why? Because verse 8 says, yet at present, we do not see everything subject to him. That's life in the bucket. Isn't that an understatement? You can tell what was there and what this should have been in all of life. I mean, standing in the river and fishing, eating good food, the delight of being with your closest friends and raising kids and loving your wife or your husband and all the richness of life that we still find, it's just echoes of what was. It was intended to be so much better and so much more beautiful. But because of sin, because of the curse, what we end up with is grieving and upheaval and violence and addiction and chaos and COVID and disruption and 200 million cases, 4 million deaths worldwide because of a disease, because of the curse. The plot line has taken a significant downturn. And you're left wondering, can this ever be made right? How does this get fixed? How does the story get restored? That's the third question, right? How did it start? What went wrong? How is it made right? That's the question that verse 3 asks. How shall we escape if we neglect such a great salvation? It's what we prayed earlier, the Apostle Paul's words, Romans 7:24. Who will rescue me from this body of death? Aren't you glad that the question is not left unanswered? There is a gospel answer. That's the good news. What was made so wrong, Jesus is making right. At the center of the passage, the center of the argument, really, verse 14 and 15, it says that through death, he, Jesus, might destroy the one who has the power of death, that is the devil, and deliver all those who through fear of death were subject to lifelong slavery. Two verbs in that rescue, how the story is made right, destroy and deliver. And the words don't mean what you think they mean. The word destroy, for example, in verse 14, does not mean what happened almost exactly a year ago in Beirut. You remember the news last year at this time, August 4th, 2020? A warehouse that was storing 3,000 tons of ammonium nitrate fertilizer exploded and wiped out much of the city of Beirut. Hundreds of people were killed, 7,500 people were injured, 300,000 people were left homeless. All that was left was a crater in that whole part of the port of Beirut. It was destroyed. That's not what the word means here in Hebrews 2:14. It does not mean to wipe out and annihilate and get rid of, leaving nothing in its wake. Rather, what it means is to render inoperative. The Greek word katergo, which is what is here for destroy, means specifically to render inoperative. Here's how this works. When my wife's granddaddy was 93 years old, he was still going into the office at the bank pretty much every day, and he was driving himself at 93 years of age. And he thought he was a much better driver than he actually turned out to be, and neighbors were calling Emily's dad and saying, your dad is treating stop signs and traffic lights as mere suggestions. And he's blowing through them. And he's driving as if no one else is on the road. He really doesn't need to be behind the wheel. And the family tried to take his keys away. And he was a very strong and determined man. And he would find spare keys. And he would keep driving in spite of all the protests of people who knew him and loved him. So one night, an arrangement was made for a mechanic to come after Emily's granddaddy went to bed, and he lifted the hood and removed one small part out of the ignition system, closed the hood, and walked away. So the next morning, Hugh, the granddaddy, woke up. He poured himself a cup of coffee, got dressed, went outside, grabbed his remote, chirp, chirp. Car unlocked, he sat inside, the lights came on, he put the key in the ignition, turned it on, the air conditioning started blowing, and the radio started playing on the talk show he had been listening to. But when he cranked the key farther, nothing. Nothing. And he sat there for 30 minutes trying to get that car to start. But it would not start and did not start because it had been rendered inoperative. It was still there. Still looked like a car, still had gas in the tank, still had potential for horsepower, but it was inoperative. That's the meaning of the word destroyed in this passage. To render inoperative. Through death, he, Jesus, might destroy the one who has the power of death, render him inoperative, and 15, and deliver all those who through fear of death were subject to lifelong slavery. The word deliver, the Greek word means to legally set free or to emancipate. If you live in the South, you've studied the Emancipation Proclamation. That's what this word means. How is this made right? How is this grand story, what was made wrong, made right? Jesus comes to destroy the enemy and to deliver all those who are captured, who are held in slavery by their fear of death, subject to lifelong slavery. So, three questions so far. How does it begin? What went wrong? How is it made right? Jesus comes. He destroys the power of the devil. He delivers those who are held in slavery by their fear of death. And then finally, how does it end? Well, this chapter hints at how it ends in verse 5, where it says, "For it was not to angels that God subjected the world to come of which we are speaking." The world to come. That's a big phrase in the book of Hebrews. And yet the writer keeps pointing out that there is a world coming where death no longer exists, where divorce no longer exists, where marriage doesn't exist. Something better will take its place. But there will not be conflict. There will not be COVID. There will not be disease. There will not be racial tensions. There will not be aging. There will not be hospitals. There will not be surgeries. There will not be intervention, no violence, sickness, heartache, or loss. There will not be grieving. Isaiah 65 says, the former things will not be remembered, nor will they even come to mind. We have a hard time imagining that kind of world. But it's a world where the special favor, the special privilege and dignity and dominion will be perfectly restored and permanently restored. Meaning that what Adam and Eve had in the garden, while it was good, it will be far inferior to what we will have. Because while what they had was perfect, it was losable. What we will have in the world to come will be perfect and unlosable, meaning not even I will be able to screw it up, nor will you. This is what lies ahead. One theologian, Arthur Pink, said, "The world to come is the renovated earth, the new heavens and the new earth, under the absolute reign of the Messiah." Listen to how else the writer of Hebrews talks about what is yet to come. Hebrews 2:8, "At present we do not yet see everything in subject to him, but that day is coming." Hebrews 13:14, "For here we have no lasting city, but we seek the city that is yet to come." Hebrews 9:28, "So Christ, having been offered once to bear the sins of many, will appear a second time, not to deal with sin, but to save those who are eagerly waiting for him." And then one of my favorite verses in Hebrews, Hebrews 12:28. "Therefore, since we are receiving a kingdom that cannot be shaken, let us be thankful and so worship God acceptably with reverence and with awe. There is a kingdom coming, and it will be ours through Christ. He will finish what he has begun. In one-word summaries, the four questions are answered with creation, fall, redemption, and then restoration, consummation, where everything is made perfect and whole and beautiful in a way that will never, ever be undone or lost. This is what's coming. Here's the point. All of history fits into this story. All of our future fits into this story. All of our past fits into this story. And everything you're wrestling with today fits into that story. Every unanswered question you have today fits into that story. Creation, fall, and all its effects, redemption, and restoration. The challenge of the book of Hebrews is don't lose the plot line. Don't drift and dull and harden from what God is doing in this story, in your life, in the complexity of all that you're facing. Everything right now is part of his story. So don't lose the plot line. You may be asking, how? How do I not lose the plot line? Well, the passage helps us in verses 16 and 18 by using that word helps three times. Verse 16, for surely it is not angels that he helps, but he helps the offspring of Abraham. Verse 18, for because he himself has suffered when tempted, he is able to help those who are being tempted. Do you need help today? You have a Redeemer who looks at you and says, can I help you? One of the biggest challenges of your life and mine will be to let him. Most of us are still like the two-year-old version of myself. I can do it by myself. I don't need your help. And our Redeemer says, all right, let me know how that works out for you. And he waits. And he says, I'm ready to help anytime you like. Interesting, the word help in verse 16 is to take hold of, to wrap his arms around us, to assure us, I'm not going to fumble you. I'm not going to forget about you. I'm not going to get irritated with you. I'm not going to get fed up. I'm not going to get bored with you. I'm going to hang on to you. That's the literal translation of that word help in verse 16. I've got you and I've got this. Man, do I need to remember that in so many places of my life. To know that my Redeemer, who with nail-scarred hands holds me and says, I've got you. I won't fumble you. I know this feels way out of control, but I've got this. And then in verse 18, when it says help, it's a different Greek word that means something slightly different. That same word is used in Mark 9:24, where the dad brings his demon-possessed son to Jesus. And he says, teacher, if you can do something to help him, please help. And Jesus looks at the man who he's distraught. His son, demon-possessed, convulses on the ground. Sometimes the demon throws him into the fire and the kid is badly damaged, traumatized from what he's experienced. And Jesus looks at the man and says, if I can do something, if all things are possible for him who believes. To which the father quickly replies, oh, teacher, I believe. Help my unbelief. Help my unbelief. And in one phrase, I've just told you my story. My story is marked by so much unbelief. Isn't yours? cognitively, I know what the Bible says. I know what Jesus can do. But every morning I wake up such a doubter. And I wonder, is Jesus really going to come through for me today? Or is he off yawning? Is he bored? Is he irritated? Is he fed up? Has he given me so many opportunities that I've messed up so many times that he said, fine, have it your way. You're on your own. And like the father whose demon-possessed son was there before Jesus, I find that my daily prayer is, Jesus, I believe. Help my unbelief. That's what verse 18 speaks to us. For because he, Jesus, has suffered when tempted, he is able and willing to help those who are being tempted. He's able to meet us in all of our unbelief, all of our drifting and dulling and hardening. And he's able to say, I've got you. I won't fumble you. And even when you go off into the far country, I'm going to bring you back. I will finish what I've started. That's the story, isn't it? How did it begin? He created it perfectly. What went wrong? The fall, the curse, and all that flows from it. How is it made right? Well, that's the gospel. That's the gospel. Jesus enters in. He becomes one of us so that what to me is my favorite verse in the Bible, 2 Corinthians 5:21, this becomes true for you and me both. God made him who knew no sin to be sin for us so that in him we would become the righteousness of God. Jesus enters fully in to all of our places of brokenness. He becomes our story. He enters into the plot line, not to stand outside of it, but to enter in and to say, your sin becomes mine. Your brokenness becomes mine. Your guilt becomes mine. Your shame becomes mine. Your grieving becomes mine. Your loss, all of the, here's a theological word, all of the yuck of your life and mine, Jesus says, I will become it. And my Father will treat me the way your life deserves to be treated. Not just that we would be forgiven, but more than that, so that Jesus' story would become ours. His perfect record of righteousness would become mine and yours. So that when the Father looks at me, he sees me just as perfect and holy and righteous and beautiful as he sees his son. That's how the story is made right. And because of that rescue in the gospel, you know how this ends. And this has to be your daily refrain and mine. We know how this ends. King Jesus returns and he makes everything absolutely and perfectly and unlosably right, so that not even you or I could mess it up. That's how this story ends. It's coming. And the letter of Hebrews keeps bringing us back to it over and over and over again. I will bring you safely home. I will finish what I've started. I've got you. And I will finish what I've started. That's what we have pictured for us in the sacrament of the Lord's Supper, isn't it? And I'm going to invite you to silently prepare your heart for the sacrament. If you have your bulletin...